Hello, Kristen.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing all right. I've started a new bad habit where I, over the course of the net ceiling debate, could not really handle watching any cable news, so I switched to CNBC, and that turned out to be a super depressing choice. As over the last week, if we're talking about a correlation here, the correlation between Kristen watching CNBC and the Dow plummeting is pretty good,
CNBC manages to squeeze in the most talking heads boxes on one screen. That was an impressive technological
feat. It's all got this kind of blue feel to it. So even though there's a lot going on, it still feels it's the most tranquil that a totally chaotic screen could possibly be.
What I understand about CNBC is it seems like no one on that channel actually knows economics. They just kind of yell really loudly. And I just don't understand who's actually in the business relies on them for economic analysis.
I don't know. I'm not really relying on the economic analysis so much as it's the vibe of the network seems to sort of be like a bunch of econ majors at a frat party, but they're all like dressed really nicely and have just had a lot of coffee instead of beer. I enjoy the vibe. It's just had a lot of really depressing news. Megan McArdle tweeted at me and advised me to watch Bloomberg instead of CNBC, but the screen wasn't busy enough, and I needed that mental stimulation of like 17 bars.
The public is still standing.
Somehow, yes. We have a deal.
But there are some folks who think that the deal will hasten the Republic's demise. And I just feel like in the aftermath of this, we've seen a starker relief of all the different ideological strains in the country, not the very simplistic left-right two-sided coin that gets talked about, but far more niches and fracturing. You know, almost all of them cranky. Almost nobody happy. I guess let me put it to you first, though. Still on the left, the general theme is that this has been awful for Obama, but is there celebration on the right that that he got outmaneuvered by Boehner and McConnell, or is there the Tea Party argument that if you haven't slashed $10 trillion in a day, that we're going to be Greece tomorrow?
I wouldn't go so far as to say $10 trillion in a day. There may be people who would like to spend $10 trillion in a day. I don't think that's a completely accurate representation.
Sure. I know my number's right. Doesn't add up?
Maybe eight. So I would say, I've heard from my friends on the left that why are Republicans and conservatives not sort of like fist pumping in excitement that we had changed the conversation so much that instead of a clean deal, we've now got these promises of, you know, cuts now, cuts later. Isn't this great? On the right, I think you had two camps going into this, and it's interesting to see how those two camps wound up. In on the one camp, you had the folks who are the Tea Party camp, the folks who were supportive of the members who voted against the initial Boehner deal and the final deal, who really thought, you know, this is the moment for us to turn on all the burners. Like, we won this election, let's really see how much we can cut, not just because cutting spending is something that we enjoy, but because we really believe that the reason why these ratings agencies are threatening to downgrade us has a lot to do with we haven't cut enough spending, so use this opportunity to cut a ton. And these folks are obviously not very happy with the end result. It doesn't mean that they necessarily think badly of, you know, John Boehner. There was a post by Robert Costa at National Review the day that the deal sort of went down. The title was, "Everyone in that room loves Speaker Boehner." It was a report from the GOP conference meeting that even the members like Jason Chaffetz, these Tea Party folks who voted against the deal, even were saying, I could not be more proud of how leadership handled this. Even to those of us who oppose the bill, he's been exceptionally good. I'm a bigger supporter of John Boehner now than I've ever been. So I think Boehner actually came out of this okay, despite Tea Party consternation about what the final deal looks like, which is kudos to him. And so, yeah, on the one hand, you have Tea Party folks, they didn't like it. On the other hand, you have conservatives who just wanted to get past this. So the sort of the Megan McArdles, Josh Barrows of the world who were just saying, Doug Holt Aiken was one example of someone who wrote a pretty frustrated column after the Boehner deal went down saying, like, conservatives, you have to realize that you won an election and that was great, but you didn't win enough seats to do the sorts of things you want to do. So you need to pull back and realize that this deal is not going to be perfect because you control one half of one branch of government. And so those folks are a little more positive, glad a deal got done, but are ultimately focused on the fact that there really weren't that many cuts, and so this actually isn't going to do much one way or another. It's politically not the same as a clean debt ceiling raise, and it changes the debate toward cutting spending, but you have over at E21, Steve McMillan, he says, as the renewed partisan sniping suggests, the Budget Control Act of 2011 defers at least as many arguments as it settles. The big numbers and bold assertions about what will happen over the next 10 years were necessary embellishments to gather enough votes to pass the bill and avoid political and market chaos that would have ensued. The real work of deficit reduction remains unsettled, meaning months or even years of continued uncertainty. So it's not necessarily anybody who's upset with Boehner or upset about the deal coming from this faction. They're just very realistic about what they believe will be lackluster accomplishments coming out of the Super Congress and sort of less deficit reduction than they may have hoped for.
Well, before I pivot to what the left is saying about it, I want to pivot a little bit to what for lack of a better word, the so-called middle is saying about it, because some of what you're saying tracks with that. Here you have the third time since the midterms, where President Obama has kind of dealt with Republicans. And you might expect that he would get criticism from the left for doing that, yet he never gets credit from pundits who position themselves or self-proclaim centrists for reaching across the aisle. He tends to get attacked anyway for the smallness of the achievement or the messiness of the process and all that sort of thing. Why is this just Bruce Washington's dysfunctional, even though they actually came to an agreement at the end of the day. I think more examples about that are less so much in the blogosphere than in cable TV. I saw a wallowing of that on Morning Joe yesterday. But there's some examples which are broadly defines the center. Ezra Klein, you might normally consider to be a liberal blogger, the Washington Post, had taken more of a right-leaning position, embracing the Gang of Six deficit reduction deal, for example, being more comfortable with raising the retirement age on Medicare and changing the inflation index for Social Security. And he lambasted this as a, quote, terrible, no good, very bad deal, going on to say, Republicans fought stimulus now and couldn't agree to the revenues necessary for significant deficit reduction later, so we got neither. We're pulling support out from under a teetering economy now, and we're punting the hard decisions on the deficit to get another committee and get another manufactured deadline. So because they didn't do the big cuts in Social Security and Medicare, the so-called center is not saying it's the voters necessarily, but the pundit class. Similarly, Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center also complained about it. It's not remotely close to solving the federal debt problem. It will reduce 2012's projected $1.3 trillion deficit by about $25 billion. This is a rounding error. And over the long haul, it shifts the baseline down, but it doesn't really bend the cost curve the other way. And then it says, it proved once again that serious long-term debt reduction can only come with increases in tax revenues and a slowdown in entitlement spending, especially for healthcare. This is not ideological theory. It's a matter of third-grade arithmetic, although I'm sure there are folks who know math that would still dispute that. But that's the general sense of certainty that's coming from those types of voices. And Major Garrett used to be, I think, went from CNN to Fox News, and now he's a National Journal, also summed up, I think, this notion of Washington dysfunction, although he sort of held back from being that extreme. But his headline was, with that deal, Congress abdicated its responsibilities, complaining about the delegation to the super committee, and saying the temptation to delegate, subcontract, and outsource the budget process will continue, legislative power will diminish, the people's voice will shrink, and the word dysfunctional might actually apply. So you have this dynamic where every time Obama tries to reach across the aisle, and from a liberal perspective, successfully did, got a bill passed, has got a number of these bills passed, even before the midterms, got Wall Street reform, got Don't Ask, Don't Tell, got Start Treaty, got even the Recovery Act. All these things, the only thing he got passed that didn't have Republican votes was health care. Everything else has. Yet he never gets that credit from the centrist class, never gets the credit from a good chunk of liberal class, and so he ends up being seen as smaller and ineffectual when he does things. And when he doesn't do things, when he comes up short in areas like, say, cap and trade or immigration reform, he takes a bit of flack, but it's not the same level of intensity that you get after a deal is done, because you get this sort of flood of commentary, and almost all that commentary is negative.
Was there any frustration with Obama? I mean, there's consternation on the left about, Obama as a negotiator. Was there any sort of discussion on the left about Obama as a negotiator versus Reid as a negotiator? Because, I mean, there was a post at Weekly Standards blog by Mark Hemingway saying, I don't think we should get ahead of ourselves here, but there's certainly a storyline emerging that when it comes to the art of the deal, Boehner is one of the more capable politicians of the era. But now that the details from the smoky bathroom debates are emerging, how's Barack Obama's reputation faring? And goes through some of the more unflattering stories about, tempers flaring on the part of Boehner, or, the bad exchange with Eric Cantor, and basically makes the case that it was Pelosi and Reid's people, that the Democratic and Republican leaders both asked Obama and his aides to leave the room at one point to let them negotiate. Is there a sense that, that Reid is a better negotiator, or is that not really a topic that it has been raised?
I haven't seen that raised in the aftermath of the final deal, and I'd say the general liberal narrative is to paint Reid as weak as they do Obama, and generally, Pelosi comes up better in the general liberal narrative as someone who stands by her caucus, stands for progressive principles, mm-hmm. and whatnot. And my personal opinion of all that is that, just to answer your question more directly, after the deal, all of the ire about weak negotiation skills gets directed to Obama. It's not spread around for the most part.
Okay.
So, for example, Matt Glaser, and this kind of runs the gamut, between people who I think are generally have more strident about Obama and those who have been more sympathetic to him over the course of these things. There's a broader range of criticism about Obama's negotiating skills in this. Matt Glaser complaining that he didn't draw a hard line about unconditional debt ceiling increases, which Bill Clinton did in the mid-90s. They sort of cut that off at the knees right away. And now there's a precedent that every debt ceiling increase will be attached to some kind of spending cuts. And Iglesias says, this seems to me like a disaster for the country. Teaching a lesson that intransigence on the specific question of the debt ceiling brings about policy concessions seems to me to signal to all members of Congress that they ought to spend the winter of 2012 and 2013 positioning themselves as intransigent on the debt ceiling. John Walker at Fire Dog Lake headlined, the next debt ceiling deal will likely be much worse, citing Mitch McConnell's comments afterwards, where he openly said that you don't want to shoot the hostage, but you want to you want to ransom the hostage, so very, 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 very bluntly, and then went on to say, I think in a separate interview, that they're going to do this all over again in 2013, that they were fully planning on it. Jonathan Cohen, the New Republic, who was probably one of the most sympathetic voices to the White House, at least taking the time to articulate the pros and cons of their actions and try to put them in a broader context, in this case, said, this is not leadership. That was his headline. And while there's this complaint amongst the centrist pundit class and the conservatives that it's not that much in cuts in the big scheme of things, as Cohen points out, what cuts are there are very concentrated in social spending, and says there's just no way to enact spending reductions of this magnitude without imposing a lot of pain, and contrary to the common understanding in the Washington cocktail party circuit, pain does not simply mean offending certain political sensibilities. Pain means more people eating tainted food, more people breathing polluted air, more people blowing their kids out of college, more people losing their homes. All that ties back into this notion of Obama getting rolled, but that's not to say that. Just to go back to what you were asking about, Obama versus the congressional leaders, just my own two cents. I mean, Reid has an effective supermajority requirement, and there are a lot of Democrats that don't like that and think that should be fought against, but there's only so much you can do about it rhetorically if Republicans are going to use a filibuster. So he has more onus to hold together an ideologically diverse caucus of his own and find Republican votes to do anything. And when Pelosi had a majority, her main goal was to count how many Democrats can I lose? How many people can I tell? You don't need to vote on this one, and it's okay because I still end up with a majority. It's a whole different dynamic that she had to deal with. And in this case, she just got to just hold back and say, to what extent do I need to release some of my caucus to let this get over the finish line? Let most of my liberal members, if they want to protest vote, they can protest vote. So she has, I personally think they're both Pelosi and Reid are very legislatively skilled, but Reid has an inherently harder job and therefore ends up looking bad and gets most of the flack for when these compromises happen. And when he does more creative legislative moves, almost never gets credit from the blogosphere about it because the end result usually involves compromise anyway.
Have there been any posts about what the expected result of the Super Congress or Super Committee will be?
Well, you're starting to see a shift towards a focus to that. In my own group, Campaign for America's Future, is we released a petition today. We're trying to pressure Pelosi and Reid to appoint people who are going to protect Social Security and Medicare and who are going to insist upon tax increases on the wealthy. One of my bosses, Robert Borsodge, had a post complaining that Boehner and McConnell had already said, we're not going to put anybody here who's going to raise taxes. And Reid said, I want to appoint people here who have open minds, saying that you have an inherently mismatched dynamic, and that's the way Democrats are going to approach this thing. And so there's definitely a lot of folks on the left, looking at the Super Committee, complaining about its structure and insisting that people should be put in there who are not going to concede to Republican demands on this issue. You have also now the White House. The White House has its own blog post today, a very defensive blog post, laying out myths and facts. And saying very baldly, myth, Obama caved in. Fact, Obama won this, this, and that. Obama's signed away revenue increases. Myth, fact, Obama is going to insist upon revenue increases, and the Bush tax cuts are going to expire in January 2013. If Congress does nothing, this is where the White House's rhetoric gets very, very tricky. They say, the president's going to veto anything that does not allow the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy to expire. And so you could interpret that two different ways. Because as a literal matter, and Lawrence O'Donnell, MSNBC, mentioned this the other day, they're not going to get a bill that says that. I mean, the question becomes, if the Super Committee gridlocks or Congress doesn't vote for what they propose, to do nothing is to let all the Bush tax cuts expire for the wealthy and the middle class. And so what is unknown at this point, what Democrats complain about, is that Obama has been reluctant to pull that trigger and say, let them all go and blame Republicans for any tax increases on the middle class because Democrats don't want to get pinned themselves for raising taxes on the middle class. And most of the money you would get from letting all the Bush tax cuts go away would come from the middle class. So to the extent that people cite figures about how much deficit reduction you would gain from letting them expire, it's largely from the middle class portion of it. I'm not saying the wealthy part of it is insignificant the way some conservatives do, but it's much bigger numbers on the middle class portion. So you could interpret the way – so clearly the White House doesn't want to say something as blunt as we'll let them all go because then they'll get hit all year long from Republicans that they're itching to raise taxes on the middle class. They're never going to say it openly. But you could either infer – that they are willing to let that happen, or if they were going to let it happen in January, they'd whip out a bill the next day, bring it to Congress saying reinstate them for the middle class, and if the Republicans don't vote for it, then blame it on them, something like that. Or you can infer from it that they're not really serious and they're going to cave in again, which is what a lot of the left now expects at this point. And I personally argue that it's just an unknown. And so to argue, as some have, that Obama has written off raising revenue, I mean, I think it's factually untrue. It's kept the issue alive for another round, at least for another round on the Super Committee, and perhaps beyond that. And you don't know what's going to happen. And to the extent that folks on the left are arguing well, Republicans, since they think he's going to cave, you know, they're going to force him into this position again. Well, they may think that, and they may be more reluctant to accept the compromise because they'll say to themselves, Obama's going to roll again. But they could be wrong.
I wonder, because last time that the Bush tax cuts were extended was when, if I'm not mistaken, Democrats had significantly larger numbers in Congress, and so I wonder if it may be the position of many Republicans that, hey, you know, we have a stronger hand than we even did last time, and last time we got an extension of everything. So why not expect an extension of everything yet again?
I mean, they may well think that.
Well, there's a little bit. There's also the issue of the sequester that kicks in if the Joint Committee fails to come to an agreement on what it is that they would like to do to find that magical 1.2, 1.8 trillion over 10 years. And there's a post Keith Hennessey wrote just this afternoon, How to Prevent Spending Cut Backsliding, where he says he's really concerned that you've got these things like the Bush tax cuts and you've got the triggered spending cuts from this the Debt Control Act that won't go into effect until, you know, much, much later on, and that the problem with politics is you've always got new people coming into office and they can always change their minds. And so he's concerned that actually around the same time that you'll be having this debate about the Bush tax cuts and what to do about them, you also may have a Congress that has realized that the Joint Committee has failed, but they also don't want to go through with the sequester. And so you see some sort of piece of legislation passes that says, oh, that sequester, we were just kidding about that. We're going to defer it. There's really not a lot of confidence, I've read, in most of these bloggers on the right or libertarian-leaning universe who really see what has happened as being a solution to these bit longer-term deficit problems. Obviously not in favor of the revenue side, but even on the spending side, not seeing it as terribly great either. Peter Suderman at Reason's Hit and Run blog said the best reason to have a big showdown over raising the debt limit was to start the process of figuring out how to deal with a federal fiscal trajectory that is simply not sustainable. Instead, we ended up with a politically motivated showdown that resulted in gimmick-filled plans full of likely bogus spending reductions, and that, if anything, ultimately made our credit outlook slightly worse by illustrating in painful and prolonged detail how difficult it will be for our political system to truly come to terms with the nation's debt problem when it eventually has to. Sorry for the long block quote there. But
I'm sure I've been a bigger offender than you today.
No, yeah. Preempting the comments.
I have a printout today. I should work things out.
So there's not a lot of confidence that the deficit situation, for my side, in terms of spending, and obviously on your side in terms of revenue increases, has really been resolved properly by this situation.
Well, that level of skepticism about the trigger from the right dovetails nicely into a part of, you know, the online story of the week, which I think is probably the least told so far. And I've gone back to this a couple times in recent segments, but there is a pro-Obama community that is growing. That's largely Twitter-based, although this week they started to add more of a blog component. And because there was such a much louder outpouring of criticism, again, left, middle, right, about the terms of the deal, it's notable that there were a handful of posts doing analyses of the details of the deal, particularly about the triggers and what political dynamics they might there might be consequences thereof. Saying that Obama pulled off a masterful job that he's not getting a proper credit for, and these are coming from people who are not well-known folks who have not become stars of the blogosphere the way certain folks on the left have. And it's very reminiscent to me of how the original liberal bloggers were started in 2002, it's actually probably more parallel to the late 90s when so much media commentary was anti-Clinton. This is in the whole, all the, you know, Monica Lewinsky, you know, type stuff. And there was this growing sense that the Washington pundit class was biased against Clinton. And you had these pre-blog sites crop up like Media Whores Online and BartCop, which were vehemently pro-Clinton and sort of began the trend of naming names in the Washington journalist class and attacking them for anti-Clinton bias. And that type of tactic hadn't really been done on the left before. And that was a precursor to the spike in blogging in 2002 when the sense was all this commentary was all Bush propaganda and other analyses of what was going on in the world weren't getting any oxygen, and so people started doing it themselves. And that created senses of community, inside jokes, lingo, sharing of links, to the point where it grew so much over the next several years, and now some of these people are becoming, you know, TV and radio stars. And you're now seeing that for Obama, in a very nascent stage, and in particular, if we get back to specific posts, you know, you saw this post from the People's View that was headlined, Paul Krugman is a Political Rookie, or How Barack Obama Left John Boehner Holding the Teabag Again. And, you know, a feature of this new pro-Obama community is to really target pundits on the left who are very hard on Obama, particularly Krugman, Glenn Greenwald, Jane Hampshire, and this one People's View post got circulated so widely through the Twitterverse that it jumped into liberal talk radio. Stephanie Miller Show picked it up and read it on air. Just to give you that sense of it, going back to sort of, it sort of tracks with what Keith Hennessey on the right was saying. The People's View said, so the president gets the debt limit increases now and the triggers don't even kick in until more than a year from now. The cuts are backloaded. Why do you suppose that is? Yeah, because Congress is notorious for changing its mind when push comes to shove. Oh, they're just supposed to happen by 2013. All right, presidential election would have intervened. And then going into the Bush tax cut part of it. In other words, do meaningful tax reform to raise revenue and take away the tax welfare state from the ultra-wealthy multinational corporations, or the highest income brackets will go up anyway. So there's definitely more of a faith that Obama has a plan in mind from these folks than what you get from other folks in the blogosphere. You also had, forgive me, it's on Bob Cheska's blog, but it's not Bob Cheska. It's one of his co-writers, and his name's escaping me. And Bob Cheska himself is not for the deal, so I don't want to put words in his mouth. That's on his blog. Talking about this whole baseline issue, which Boehner and the White House are going back and forth about, because apparently, well, Boehner is saying, and Republicans say that the deal locks in the use of current law baseline, and current law is which tax cuts expire. So when you see these CBO projections, they assume all this revenue is going to come in 2013 because they're all going to expire. And a lot of the proposals that have come out from Simpson-Bowles, the baselines they were working for in earlier negotiations, did not presume that. They presumed that the tax cuts would expire for the wealthy, and then and whether a proposal would lose or would cut or increase the deficit would be relative to that presumption. And so the Republicans are arguing as well, if you presume that all the Bush tax cuts expire, then and that's a lot of revenue. So let's say you do some kind of tax reform compromise that would increase revenue, not considering the Bush tax cuts expiring. The CBO would formally score it as an increase in the deficit because it would not gain as much revenue as if it would if you kept the Bush tax cuts. Or if you let the Bush tax cuts expire, not going to increase that everybody. So they're arguing that by keeping the current law baseline, they make it harder for compromise proposals to gain traction because they won't be scored as actually raising revenue, technically speaking. And the White House is saying, well, that's not even true. The deal doesn't insist upon that baseline, so that's all. And I haven't read the nitty-gritty of the bill, so forgive me. I can't think who's right or wrong there. But there's definitely a dispute on that point. But what this guy who writes on Bob Cheska's blog was suggesting is by keeping that as the current law baseline, sure, it might make it harder for a tax proposal to gain traction, but it also makes it likely for any proposal to gain traction. It makes it more likely that those tax cuts do actually expire and get that revenue. So that argument is out there. But my overarching point, beyond all the particulars of their analyses, is there is a community out there that is putting out pro-Obama arguments. They don't get a lot of attention in the traditional media right now, but neither did Glenn Greenwald or Jane Hampshire back in the day. And so you may see this group, and if you're on Twitter, you know, some of the leading likes there are Angry Black Lady and Shock, S-H-O-Q, Jefferson Obama. They have their own, you know, hashtags like TFI, which is Team F Yeah. You know, these types of things are starting to percolate out there and may, over the course of the next year and beyond, if Obama gets a second term, may actually have more resonance in the dialogue.
So, but you wouldn't consider these folks to necessarily be analogous to, so on the right we have like the David Frums of the world who are at odds with the Eric Ericsons of the world who would, you know, are critical even of Republicans and conservatives for not being Republican or conservative enough. These aren't necessarily ideologically more centrist, they're just pro-Obama?
I'd say predominantly yes, okay. But so most of the arguments are usually about, you know, is Obama being... is he being generally liberal or progressive in his strategic approach and being very crafty about it, or is he inherently a big giant sellout or a caveman? You know, there's a split in the anti-Obama left whether Obama is weak or actually conservative.
Okay.
Krugman has actually been making the case more and more that Obama is actually conservative and he wants these conservative outcomes. So stop using as an excuse that he's merely weak and spineless. And Glenn Greenwald has also often made that same point. You see from the pro-Obama Twitter forces a defense of Obama as a person of being sincere in his liberal progressive values. Now, I do wonder, though, I happen to think, based on everything that's transpired over the past few weeks, that to take Obama at his word, he does want the grand bargain. He does want a deal that is going to slow growth of entitlements / cut benefits, depending on how you want to interpret it, in exchange for higher taxes on the wealthy. He wants to be able to say that he solved the problem and get it off the table. There's always been a train of thought within the White House that someone's going to reform Social Security one of these days, might as well be us, and we'll do it in the least offensive way possible and maintain the integrity of the program. And other folks left have said that's just crazy, there's not even a serious crisis there, you're walking into a conservative trap. That is a dangerous thing to do. And there's always been a certain bit of opaqueness where Obama actually stood on it, but I think you have to look at what's happened most recently. Knowing that this deal was proffered to Boehner and turned down by Boehner, and to hear Obama's rhetoric after the deal saying, look, I want out of the super committee a proposal that's going to reform entitlements and raise revenue. I mean, I don't think there's any other way to interpret that. So to the extent that there may be a continued push for that going forward, I want to see the specifics of what reforming entitlements actually is. It'll be interesting to see if the pro-Obama forces on Twitter, if it becomes more of an ideological dispute, if it becomes more of, you know what Obama's talking about on Social Security and Medicare, this isn't that big of a deal. It's only, it's shaving benefits years in into the future relative to other projections. It's so no one's going to even interpret it as a cut when they actually get their check. It's going to be more than what they ever expect anyway. Or if, and versus what other folks left would say, saying this is a cut, it's a cut, it's a cut. You're betraying the program. You're weakening the pillars that have existed for 70 years, and you're trashing the New Deal. So it could end up being a more ideological debate, but as of yet, I don't think it's reached that point yet. Right now, it's more personality centric. Do you think Obama's a good guy or not?
Okay. Well, one of the other issues that I've, the Krugmans and such have levied is that Obama's not focused enough on the jobs issue. That because he's so focused on spending, and that he's sort of gotten caught in the Republican rhetoric about the need to cut spending, that's caused him to not be focused on jobs. Hence, now I believe different reports have different things, but it's either the seventh or up to the 15th time that the Obama administration has pivoted onto the jobs issue. So is that something that you've seen any sort of buzz about this week in terms of, to what extent that the debt deal is impacting the economy?
Yeah, and I think Bernard Lee actually made that same crack that this is the 15th pivot to jobs.
Not just the right.
No. There's definitely folks on the left that have made that same complaint. You will see mocking references to recovery summer a fair amount, in the left Twitter sphere. And for a more substantive argument that has become a bit of a touchstone argument on a lot of corners of the left, David Woolner at the New Deal site talks about how Obama is repeating the mistake of FDR in 1937 when they thought they had a good enough handle on the economy, they could pull back on the deficit spending, return to a balanced budget, and the economy would still be on a good glide path, and they ended up suffering what was known as a recession or a second depression, however people want to interpret it, and it only got resolved after they reversed course, and then of course the war happened, and they then went in big on deficit spending after that. So that is a story that's been retold a lot on the left, and even early on in the White House, you say we know the lessons of 1937, trust us, we're not going to make that mistake again. And David Woolner argued President Obama sells the Budget Control Act of 2011 as a victory for the American people, as an important first step in solving the deficit crisis, but he's missed a fundamental point: the most effective way to reduce the federal deficit in the long term is to spur economic growth in the short term. And I know that John Judis at the New Republic, after Obama's speech to the nation last week, chastised him for not educating the public on that argument. Instead of relying on phrases like live within our means, he didn't make the academic economic case for additional spending now, and therefore it's why he doesn't have a mandate to do it. So you still have that critique out there, but I think when you read some of the more pro-Obama commentary on Twitter, you tend to see argued, look, there's a Republican House, the votes aren't there, don't blame Obama for something that is not legislatively possible to do. All you can do is try to get past what you can pass. So those strains in argument are there. But certainly, you can't deny the White House is aware that people care more about jobs than the deficit, despite what their legislative focus has been on. I mean, for Obama to come out right after this deal is done and give a speech that was 90% about jobs, at minimum, it does speak to an awareness that they have an issue with the public in terms of jobs, and they want to be able to say, there are things we want to do, we know there's things to do, we're not pretending that our work is done here, here are our ideas, and if they don't get passed, don't blame us, blame the folks that are blocking them. They're clearly trying to set up that sort of argument, and how effective that can be done, obviously, is a difficult thing to predict.
Well, and then you've already seen in the just right out of the gate that one of the things that Obama is trying to make the case for is that this current economic turmoil that we're in is a result of Republicans holding the debt ceiling in the product of the left holding hostage. Which I always thought that would be a point that they would use if the debt ceiling wasn't raised and there was panic, but I suppose it makes sense to use it anyways, considering that there's sort of economic consternation anyways. But in an attempt to sort of try to push the blame for the economy somewhere else, because it is so unhelpful for Obama's reelection chances that the economy be in such bad shape, and if it appears that the president is not focused on jobs or does not have a way out, it's certainly not a good situation for him. There's a really sort of depressing post by Dave Weigel at Slate today, where he goes through Boehner's office released a press release all about Obama's pivoting to jobs again. And Weigel post had, I think, a very good point. He says, the White House's jobs agenda is always, always a rebranding of stimulus spending. The GOP's jobs agenda is always a cocktail of plans they've already proposed. Good ideas, just not representative of a surge of GOP job ideas. The horrible truth is that Democrats are not being stopped from implementing ideas that will grow the economy at double speed, nor is it that Republicans are being stopped from unleashing bold new ideas that will fix the housing or employment crises. The truth is that no one knows what to do in the short term. So to the point that you made about how, there are some of these pro-Obama bloggers who are saying, oh, well, Obama can't really fix the economy anyways, like he probably wants to, because Republicans control the House. I kind of find myself agreeing with the Dave Weigel post that it's not that Democrats have, like, this really great, jobs package that they'd love to pass if only it were not for those Republicans in the House, but that instead you sort of get this resounding silence, unfortunately, from both sides about, okay, what will you do to lower the unemployment rate? That both sides have, like, little bits and pieces of ideas. You know, on the Republican side, it's a lot of deregulation and, you know, targeted lower corporate tax rates and things. But it's the things that Republicans have always been saying. It's sort of no new magic plan. So that was kind of depressed me.
Well, I don't think that's fair on the Democratic side. Okay. There are specific ideas that they're talking about. I think some smaller than others. I mean, I think you could say that, you know, additional payroll tax cut or extending unemployment insurance benefits again, which the president talks about a lot, fairly criticizes. That's not really a new idea. That's just maintaining what you have right now for stimulus. So it wouldn't be worse. It'd be worse if it went away next year, but it's not adding.
But that is kind of a rebranding of stimulus spending, though.
It's a continuation. Right? If it was just that, I would agree with what Weigel is saying. But, you know, in the midterms, he put forth a $50 million infrastructure package and he couldn't get enough support even from Democrats during the midterm elections around that, so that did not get reiterated this week. What did get reiterated this week was the infrastructure bank idea, which Obama has always had. It was in his initial campaign platform, and there's now a proposal for that that's bipartisan. It's John Kerry and Gabriel Hutchinson. It has AFL-CIO and Chamber of Commerce support. It's only $10 billion of federal money, and that's for loans. And the argument from Kerry and Hutchinson is that it would be seed money for public-private partnerships that would leverage $600 billion in private money over the course of 10 years. And the Kerry Hutchinson folks have not made put a hard jobs number on it, but just my own personal extrapolations. There tends to be a thumbnail argument that for every billion in infrastructure spending, you get 36,000 jobs. If that held true for 600 billion over 10 years, you get 21 million jobs. It's not as big as it sounds over a 10-year period, but it's not nothing either. That's a pretty concrete idea. It's a feasible idea. It has some initial bipartisan support, but there's no evidence. It hasn't gotten a lot of co-sponsors, despite the fact having big labor and big business actually coming together on it. And I think that's not just the same rehash of what's already been done. It's not just a brand new idea, but arguably there's plenty of folks on the left that don't love the idea of public-private infrastructure partnerships. Robert Reich actually criticized it as saying if there's too much private involvement, that would mean a lot of user fees that would negate stimulative impact. So it's not a universal position, but it's certainly a new idea that hasn't been implemented yet.
It is a twist on stimulative spending, but again, it is sort of a rebranding of the spending of government money in part to stimulate action elsewhere to create jobs, which is similar to, in the sense that many of the Republican ideas all sort of coalesce around a similar theme of getting government less involved. And so while an infrastructure bank...
It speaks to the basic ideological differences of the two parties.
Well, right, but is an infrastructure bank going to dramatically reduce our unemployment rate, or is it going to create, a couple thousand jobs, maybe tens of thousands of jobs, and that's wonderful and great. We should, be creating any jobs we can, but is that really, fixing... Is that a Band-Aid, or is that fixing the problem? And I think... The big problem is that, does either side have a cure that is fixing the roots of the problem, or do we have these nice band-aids like an infrastructure bank or, new energy exploration projects as one of the Republican ideas? Or are these really fundamentally going to jumpstart things, or are they thinking big enough?
I mean, I think the argument is that it's not just a little bank on the corner to fund a few projects here or there. I mean, the American Society of Civil Engineers has long said that we have $2 trillion worth of infrastructure repairs to do. That doesn't even count all the modernization that could be that arguably should be done. If you're going to leverage $600 billion worth of private money, that's a long way. That's not a chump change proposition. That would theoretically unleash a pretty major long-term project of American infrastructure improvement. But it's got to pass, of course. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to pass tomorrow. It doesn't look likely, but I wouldn't say it's a small bore idea. It arguably is a fairly transformational idea.
Well, I'm hoping that anybody can come up with something that will prevent the Dow from doing what it did today. Although we may have to look to our friends across the Atlantic for them to clean up their own situation before we can get any sort of calm or certainty on that front.
Well, should we leave it on that note?
I think we should.
All right. Always good to talk to you.
Good talking to you too, Bill.
And where can folks find your work?
You can find my work. I post links to everything at kristensoltis.com. So that's sort of a central hub for everything.
And you can find my stuff at ourfuture.org and liberaloasis.com, home of the Liberal Oasis radio show podcast. Are you still doing the podcast stuff?
Yes. So I still do the show. I think we just settled on a name, Washington Watch for PJTV, but also the Bill Stern Washington show through Variety. So it's sort of the outreach to Hollywood. I get to be the conservative. It's a fun show. We tape it on Fridays, or if you can listen in live on Blog Talk Radio. Ted Johnson of Variety is the host, and I'm sort of their token conservative. And tomorrow our topic is Republicans and civil unions, gay marriage, gay rights, and young voters, and we're being joined by Margaret Hoover. So for viewers...
Related to the famous Robert Hoover?
Yes, indeed. We have a great-granddaughter, and she just has a book out called American Individualism, sort of about how to save conservatism as sort of cultural trends are sort of had been, at least in the last few cycles, pushing young people more towards the Democratic Party and to the left. How can you make conservatism appealing and show young people who may be searching for political identity, you know, what conservatism can mean as far as individual liberty and all that. So anyhow, it should be an interesting show. Hopefully as interesting as this one was today.
Hey, aim high.
I know, high standards. All right, Bill, it was good talking to you.
You too. Take care.